K-E-N-T, first name. Britain, just like the country, second name. Cold letters, Whiskey Alpha 5, Victor Juliet Bravo. You can get to them in a couple of different ways. Go to thatcoldletters.com, and you'll see a website of the antennas that he makes. He's a ham radio operator who makes antennas and sells them. Rather good looking thing. When you do a proper Google search, or maybe search some bad back issues of CQ Ham Radio Magazine in your library, you'll find articles by him. Roughly every other month, he has an article in his column about antennas in CQ Ham Radio. Almost all good libraries will have back issues of CQ Ham Radio. If you look at the back issues, I'm pretty sure Kent has an article on coat hanger Yagi antenna. I'm going to be talking to Kent personally in 1 hour. I'm going to ask him the question. So when you come back to the TechNet next week, Danny, I will have an answer from the horse's mouth, Kent himself, as to where to go to get that Yagi design. And as you start building this arrangement to make your signal louder, it may not be an immediate success, but as you start doing it, as it starts working, or starts not working, you're going to come back to the TechNet, you're going to tell us what works, you're going to tell us what doesn't work, and me and the other guys here are going to say, that's good, now go do this, and it'll get better. So you can't fail. I think you see what's on the way to you, Danny. KC2TFS, K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Yeah, thank you very much, Dick. It's been a lot of help. I've listened to the TechNet many times, and I've listened to what you guys are talking about, and it's like another language to me. I have no clue what you're talking about. But I'm slowly beginning to understand it, and I'm beginning to enjoy this a lot. You guys might tell me an email, so I might not be on the TechNet next week. So if I'm not there, can you email it to me? You just tell me an email, so if you get anything, I'll just send you my email for the change feed right now. And what I have on QRZ is not going to be my email that I'm using anymore. And I'll send you an email with more about what the system is. So that if I'm not on the TechNet next week, you can have Ken email me some stuff to help me. That would be very much appreciated. I'm very thankful for this information. It's going to help me a lot. Very much. It's been a great help. K2RWKCTFS in the TechNet.
Yeah, I think I know what you're asking for, Danny. And you've made a reasonable sounding request. I've got to turn you down. I'm on the last request. The problem that Nell and I, the two moderators of the TechNet, run into is we get a tremendous number of requests for information, which is basically people through written means, email and whatever, want us to run a completely free, private consulting service. We can't do that. Can't handle it. I've got a life to live. I've got an occupation to handle. I'm willing to put a few hours of my time into a Sunday night live conversation on the subject. I'm a very slow typer with two fingers, fine and peck. I'm a very slow typer. I can talk 150 words a minute when I get excited. I can only type 10 words a minute. And when it's not being done live, as it is right now, with people signing in and helping me and giving me extra information, you're getting a much lower quality signal, so to speak. If you're not available for the TechNet next week, that's not the end of the world. You'll be there in 2 weeks. The information will still be there. You're going to get it. We're just discussing when you're going to get it and in what form you're going to get it. You're going to get the information. So when I find out from Kent the best place to go, when I talk to him in an hour, I'll write it down on my yellow pad here that's on my table. And so if I don't meet you for 2 weeks, it'll still be there. You're going to get it. We're just not sure when. And don't blame me for asking. If you were the only person on the planet doing it, I would go for it. You'd be amazed how many people listen to us and how many letters we get and how angry they are because they think you're the only one and they're not getting the answer of 5 pages of information specifically written for them. We didn't volunteer to do that. That wasn't the original promise of this TechNet. You come to this TechNet with a live question, you're going to get a live answer, the best we can get from the cadre of, to the assembled group of so-called experts. That's the best you're going to get. When you get down to writing to one of us, it's slow, lower in quality, and we didn't volunteer to do that. So, I'm not trying to be nasty, I'm just trying to be realistic here. I'm spread too thin. My family's hollering, I don't spend enough time. My clients, my main clients I work with as a consultant is hollering, but I don't give him enough time. And so, I gotta form a compromise here somewhere. Good luck with that project, Danny. It's gonna work like a charm. It's just gonna be a
repeater, timeout.
It's just going to work a little bit slower than you would like it to. I think we've answered all of the questions of the people who signed in. I'm not sure about that, but I'm soon going to find out whether or not I've answered all the questions of the people who signed in. If not, give me your call letters right now. K2LIW in the TechNet. K2LIW.
K2LIW.
See, recognize? You got to see it.
Y-Y-Y.
And Joe recognized in that order. Steve first, go ahead.
Hey, I'm calling for the tech guy.
Did anyone send out the
tech guy? Looking forward to the time I can get that information.
Okay, you two guys doubled. I heard one of you through the machine and one of you through the input. Unfortunately, I got confused. I know that you've got a sign, Danny, so please repeat your question, Danny, and then I'm going to go over to Steve and Joe in that order. Danny, repeat your message.
Okay, this is KC2TSS. I fully understand. Not angry at all, but I want to get out that information. Thank you for giving me a look forward to the next time I can be on the net. Thanks for all you've done tonight on 73 that I went on the net. Besides, go to sleep because I've got to go to school in the morning. Thanks for the information. Be happy to use it. K2RIW, KC2CSS 73. I'm clear.
Very fine, Danny. And, you better hurry up and get to sleep so you can get to school in the morning. Now, Steve, you'll have to repeat your question. I tried copying both and I got nothing. You got it, Steve.
No problem, Dick. No problem at all. Did that other gentleman ever give out the website address for that Orbitron satellite tracking software?
Yeah, that was Fred KC2OES. All we know is that if we Google Orbitron, we're likely to find it. He's going to do some further searching. Let me do a standby if Fred is there. Okay. We know Fred is KC2OES, so one way or another we'll get a hold of him if Google won't give you good information on the word Orbitron. Orbitron. You got it, Steve.
No, Dick, I found it. I found that I was going to give the address myself. It's
stoff.pl/. That's all? That gives you that is the web address of Orbitron?
Yeah, I do believe so. I'll double check it. If it's not, I'll let you know. But that's what came up on my screen when I pulled it up. Back to you.
Sounds awful good. Okay, Joe, you got it.
Thank you, Dick. Good evening. It's one-way here. You were talking about direct TV stuff before. I had a question, actually a comment and a question. I have that service, limited, and what I noticed with it, when it's going to crap out, is that not all the transponders crap out at the same time. Some have, you know, 10 or 20% difference, if that's a linear scale you can use with the signal strength meter on the thing. Some are quite a bit different in signal strength than others, and some channels carry out, some transponders may crap out first. So you may never be able to improve the signal to a point where it's always going to, you know, not lose any channels. My question I have with that service is, what is spot beam technology?
Okay, I hear the words of your question, and I'm not sure what you're asking. Spot beam technology. We're talking about the fact that the satellite has an antenna pattern aimed at Earth, and they have the ability, at least the designer of the satellite has the ability, to set up the antenna pattern so that it favors a particular piece of geography on the planet Earth. That's part of what those words mean, but you may be asking something beyond that. How do they electronically move it? How do they make it that different transponders have different footprints? Not quite sure what you're asking, so give me more words of your question, Joe. Go ahead.
You basically hit one of them. Some transponders apparently can be made to have a certain footprint, like some transponders on certain channels, I guess your decoder box automatically would translate some channels from what they actually are to numbers you can realize what they are. They can put certain patterns in certain areas of the country, like, say, like the northeast corner, from, say, like Maryland or Maryland on up to the entire northeast. You could get some channel there. Whereas with the same decoder box you took it down to Florida, you wouldn't get some of them channels. They just wouldn't be decodable anymore.
There's a yes and a no to that. There are people who travel around the United States or North America with a much larger than normal size dish. If the footprint favors Maryland to Maine and out to Chicago, and therefore that particular service was not intended for Key West. And I drive down to Key West to attend one of their parties, let's say, like the Fantasy Fest. I'm getting into a delicate area here, I'll warn you. But I decided to go down there and watch the shenanigans of the Fantasy Fest in fall in Key West, which I think takes place in September or October of each year. And I bring along a larger satellite dish, and because the footprint is favoring Maryland up to Maine, and I'm way down there in Key West, I may be at a place where the footprint is 5 decibels weaker. But if I'm smart enough to bring along with me a dish that's got 5 decibels more gain, I'm back in the ball game. So there are lots of people who will go far outside of the footprint as a hobby or because of their occupation or whatever, and use a bigger dish and bring it back in. Back to you, Joe.
Well, would 5 decibels be enough where your decoder couldn't copy the signal anymore? Is it that sensitive?
Oh, one of the things you should know. True of digital service television, not quite as sharp, but there's a similar characteristic. I'm going to call it the crashing characteristic of satellite FM reception, FM modulated video satellite. If my conventional old-fashioned television receive-only terminal, listening to an S-band or KU-band signal, before it's digitally modulated, back in the old days, had 9 decibels of carrier-to-noise ratio in the 35 meg bandwidth of the decoder. 9 decibels of carrier-to-noise ratio I've got with a well-designed demodulator, essentially a snow-free picture. At 8 decibels of carrier-to-noise ratio, it's starting to get a lot of snowflakes in there. By the time you get down to 7 or 6 decibels of carrier-to-noise ratio, the picture is thoroughly unwatchable. it happens that fast. In the case of digital television over the air broadcast, there's less than one decibel between good picture and no picture. It crashes real fast. So if you go 5 dB out of the normal footprint, and you had a system that worked with 2 dB of margin before, and you now use 5 decibels more gain of the antenna when you're down in Key West, 5 decibels out of the footprint. In other words, the footprint tells me, if I go to the White website, I find out the footprint down there for my favorite transponder is 5 decibels weaker than it would have been when I'm sitting in Boston. And I've got 5 dB more gain. I still got the same 2 dB of fade margin, but it's the same quality of signal. Back to you, Joe.
Okay, you said digital, if it has more than a 1 dB change in the signal strength, that's going to be the difference between a watchable picture and a non-watchable picture. Then I guess the signal strength indicator on my particular unit, 100 being maximum and 0 being nothing, it gets down to about a range of about 40, and that's about the cutoff point. 40 and below, the picture just breaks up and pretty much disappears after that. 40 and above, all the way up to 100, it's a watchable picture.
Understand. And so, you are probably thinking that those numbers represented decibels. They do not. It's an arbitrary scale, and I think you know that ahead of time. And it's got a crazy crashing characteristic. Once you approach the threshold and you start seeing degradation of picture, in both cases, an extremely small number of decibels of further change will wipe out that picture for you. It's got that crashing effect. FM demodulation has that. Digital television has a much stronger version of it. On top of that, depending on the way your particular signal strength indicator is wired and designed, and depending on which particular service we're talking about, what you're calling signal-to-noise ratio or signal strength indication might really be the inverse of bit error rate. If your bit error rate was 10 to the minus 6, it may represent 60 on that indicator. And if you go from 10 to the minus 6 to 10 to the minus 7 bit error rate, the 60 might become 80. So in some cases, what's called signal strength indicator is bit error rate of demodulation of that particular signal condition. So B2RYY, K2RYW.
Now that seems to make some sense, and of course I realize that the scale is not directly decibels. That would be, that's a huge difference between going from 100 down to 40. I realize it's probably some sort of linear type of scale or something representing something like that. But I've also noticed that there's only like, say, three transponders that will stay up there quite a bit as far as signal strength. All the rest of them pretty much will drop really quickly when they get, a good rainstorm coming by. Not to the point I'll lose the reception, but they, will come out about 10 or 20 numbers compared to like three, which pretty much stay up at 95 to 100 most of the time. Actually, three of them get on 100 most of the time. And the rest of them are like 95 and above, so I guess I got an aim pretty good. Okay, I guess you basically answered my question when I was looking for.
Yeah, there's another implied question you didn't ask, but it's implied by what you said. And that is, certain transponders will stand up there in the rainstorm and certain will not. I know you're curious about why. How come transponder 3 survives the rainstorm and transponder 7 is the first one to always die? There's about two or three reasons for that. Number one, the different transponders could be designed for different areas of the country, therefore they have a different footprint. So transponder number 3 may be strong footprint in your area, and transponder number 7 may be a weak footprint in your area. That's one factor. Number two, in some cases they're designing the footprint for various services for transponders. In some cases the design happened whether they care about it or not. And making the footprint for channel 3 favor Boston and transponder 7 favor Miami. In the meantime, transponder number 5 may have done something that's not exactly what they want, but they got no choice. That's another factor. But now when it comes to cross-coupling, if you made yourself a diagram where you had a bunch of horizontal rectangles, you got a bunch of rectangles stacked end-to-end horizontally, and you mark the first rectangle 1, the next one adjacent to it, touching it 3, the next one 5, the next one 7. Those rectangles could represent the frequency region occupied by that transponder. Now overlap with that another rectangle that bridges the gap between 1 and 3, and that's transponder number 2. Make another one that bridges the gap between 3 and 5, and that's transponder number 4. Overlapping frequency region. So now, if I want to listen to transponder number 2, which is overlapping with half of number 1 and half of number 3, and if number 2 happens to be a strong transponder because of its footprint and power output, whatever, in my locale, 2 is a strong one, and 1 and 3 both happen to be weak ones, and I'm watching number 2, as those great big raindrops come along, they're going to be creating cross-coupling between the clockwise and counterclockwise polarization of the odds and the evens of what I just described. But if the undesired ones are the weak ones, I can tolerate a hell of a lot more trans-coupling or cross-coupling before I lose number 2, and vice versa. If I want to watch number 3, and it's a weak one, alongside a strong one, number 2, that's the first one I'm going to lose at my locale. Through the experiment and
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Through the experiment in some other part of the country, which has a different series of footprints, and you'll get a different set of results as to how much rain tolerance you've got for that particular transponder. Let's see if that makes some sense to you, Joe, of A2RYY, A2RYW.
Well, what I noticed, the pattern I noticed is this. The transponder numbers I can see are numbered 1 through 32. 28 being the weakest one all the time. It's about typically, gives me an indication range of about 89 to 90. Everything else is about usually 95 to 100. And transponders 4, 12, and 18 are always at 100 all the time, unless you get a really serious rainstorm. Even a light rainstorm, they're still up at 100, the others will drop down maybe to 90 or below. So that's a pattern I pretty much noticed.
Okay, so week 28 is the weak one to you. When a rainstorm comes along, is 28 one of the ones that you're likely to lose?
Well, it'll drop down first, but the thing is what I cannot do is I cannot tag a channel, a receiving channel, marry it to a transponder. I don't know how to do that. I don't think the box is capable of telling me that, so I can't tell what program is coming out of what transponder. I can only read the transponders on the setup, system setup, the dish pointing. That's all. Can't do anything else but read the signal strength of each transponder.
Okay. If you go to the right website, and maybe Eric can help us on this, I'm reasonably sure there is a way that transponder 28, the weak one, you can find out what channels of information is associated with today. I'm guessing there is a spreadsheet somewhere in the world that'll give you that particular information. So the first person I would ask that one is Eric to see if he can help. Somewhere that information is available. We just haven't found out how to get to it yet. Back to you, Joe.
K-Y-X.
Hey, he found this out better. Go ahead, Mel.
I'm here.
Okay, Mel first, and then Eric in that order. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, well, would you just please leave a little time? I promise one email to the Ducks and Iola.
Sure will. Okay, yeah. Eric, go ahead with your info.
What are we talking about? The EchoStar, Dish, DirecTV, which one?
Whichever one he was watching, it was transponder 28. He's going to eventually tell us, but he wants to know what particular program channel out of his demodulator is associated with. Did I get that one right, Joe? Oh, you, Joe. And then you sent it to Eric.
Yes. to serve as a DirecTV.
DirecTV is rather hard. This network is easy. The actual layout of the transponders is published, but not the contents of what's in the screen. And generally, as with the EchoStar, it regularly shifts. It's in, you know, it's invisible, it's transparent to the user, because the appropriate channel information is associated with the channel numbers. It also depends upon what spot beam you happen to be sitting on. And by the way, Dick, you're right. It's left and right-hand polarization for both EchoStar and DirecTV. And the KA is, there's two different kinds. One is circular, one linear. RWKE2J.
So KA, the difference for KUs are all circular, clockwise and counterclockwise, is what I think I heard. Is that correct, Eric?
That's right, as opposed to the commercial satellites, which are all linear.
Yeah, in the case of commercials, you guys are willing to tune the polarimeter. In the case of a home service, that's much more nebulous, and I can see why it's circular. And let me think now. With linear polarization, would the raindrops still be creating cross-coupling? And I think the answer is a definite yes. Yeah, the answer is a definite yes. By a slightly different mechanism, it's going to do it. And there's one other variable we should know about here. And that is, the deeper the dish, the worse the problem. A 0.3 FOVD dish that you set up for clockwise circular polarization is unintentionally transmitting some of the cross-polarized signal. There's something about the way the geometry of a deep dish works. And Dr. Dick Turin, W2IMU, had a number of articles in antenna propagation on this subject back in the 70s. And it's good stuff. Not easy to understand. If you make the dish flatter and flatter with a longer and longer focal length to diameter ratio, this problem gets much, much less. So, you've got a certain amount of cross-coupling that takes place in your antenna itself. And then Mother Nature, with her great big raindrops, does it more. So in a few cases, you can get a little bit of improvement by using a longer focal length dish. Well, the DirecTV type 18-inch dish with its offset feed already is a 0.7 or 0.8 FOVD ratio. So they've already done that. You're not going to gain much on that one. Okay, we better drop this and go over to Mel, and you better answer at least one email, or he's going to get more hate mail, and he's going to lose more sleep, and we don't want that to happen. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY, yeah, Roger. Yeah, I've got a number of emails here, but I promised one to answer these young people, and they are trying to really get into amateur radio, and one of the study periods that they went through, they said that they had discussed three basic dipoles, a folded dipole, a bowtie dipole, and a cage dipole, and they'd like to know something about each, which one is basically the best one to install for HF operation. Especially they'd like to start out in fact, they'd like to start out in the CW mode, take over.
Okay, which is best? Would I be happier if I marry a blonde, a brunette, or a redhead? And which antenna is best? In both cases, there's a lot more variables than first DPI. If you have the resources, I think I can safely say a cage dipole is always the best among the dipoles. But the resources to do that on 80 meters significantly are heroic. To make a cage dipole with a, let me pick a number, a 0.05 diameter radiator cage on the left-hand side and the right-hand side of the dipole, that's going to take a lot of copper, a lot of resources, a lot of spreaders, and it's difficult. And the amount of improvement you get is worth fighting for, but you're going to pay heavily for it. Now, when it comes to ordinary dipole versus folded dipole, the performance of those in gain, pattern, and bandwidth are almost identical. There's very little, in my mind,
improvement over folded dipole, over regular dipole, with one exception. In one case, I'm feeding a 70 ohm antenna, that's a real dipole. In the other case, I'm feeding a 300 ohm antenna, that's the folded dipole. If I had selected open wire line, 300 ohm, 600 ohm, 500 ohm, 400 ohm, open wire line, a very low loss, high performance transmission line, then the folded dipole comes much closer to matching that, and it's a much nicer combination, a much better marriage. If I took 600 ohm open wire line and directly feed an ordinary 70 ohm dipole, that's a pretty big jump in impedance right at that connection point. It'll work, but you're going to have to fight pretty hard with the antenna tuner to make it work. So these are some of my thoughts on the subject of those three dipole types. And by the way, when it comes to feeding a dipole, there's a zillion ways of doing it. Feeding it directly in the center. Feeding it directly in the center with a hairpin coil located at the center. Feeding it with a delta match at the center. Folded dipole. Feeding it with a T match. Feeding it with a gamma match. All of these have very close to the same electrical performance, but because of your methods of construction and what's available to you, one of those techniques will be easier for you to implement. So there's a zillion ways to feed a dipole. Another thing worth considering, and this is a very well-kept secret, let me drop. Back to that dipole where I decided to be simple. In the case of an 80-meter dipole, making a real folded dipole at 80 meters mechanically is difficult. A straight dipole at 80 meters is very easy. But a straight dipole at 80 meters is a 72-ohm impedance at the center. And I decide that I've got this beautiful roll of 600-ohm, very low-loss, open-wire line. And I want to use that open wire line. Therefore, I'd love that dipole to have 600 ohms of impedance. I can make that happen. The well-kept secret is that a dipole is only 72 ohms long when you make it electrically half-wavelength long. You allow me to make it a little bit longer, and the resistive component starts climbing real fast. Chapter 4, Antenna Engineering Handbook, I think it's graph number 4-3, will show that to you. Make the dipole a little bit longer or shorter. I can make the resistive component go anywhere from 1 ohm to 2,000 ohms by doing nothing but adjusting the length. And after I adjust that length, to make it 600 ohms, to match my particular 600 ohm wire, in the center of an ordinary dipole, and I've now forced a beautiful resistive impedance match. Yes, there's some reactants left over. Antenna's a little bit inductive. I hang a capacitor across that feed point, and now I've got it all. I've got a 600 ohm antenna. I've got no standing wave ratio at my desired antenna frequency. I've got 600 ohm wire, the lowest loss feed line I can lay my hands on at a reasonable price, and I've got it all together, and I've got my cake, and I eat it too. You'd be amazed how many variations are on simple looking antennas, and some of these things are not published. There's probably a lot more to it that you'd like to add, but these are some of my first thoughts on it now. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Well, you know, back in my day, I guess in your day, I should have moved you because it was parallel time, both of us. The folded dipole with 300 ohm twin lead was very popular because at that time the 300 ohm twin lead was used for all the television antennas. Everything was the TV at that time was 300 ohm. So the twin lead was very available, very, very cheap. So I found by making a 300 ohm parallel line for twin lead was very popular with a lot of people. In fact, the 300 ohm, just continuous 300 ohm wire to split at the feed point and went into a tunis of that kind. Balanced input of tunis is very popular. So it is not as popular anymore. If you're looking for something with coax, you can also look still at an old type dipole and fed with a 4-to-1 balun and use 75 ohm coax, believe it or not, to the transmitter, and it still will work quite well. A little bit more of a problem to put up a bow tie type of dipole, a little bit more involved. But listen, there's all kinds of dipoles put up, sloping type dipoles, and they'll all work, and I think that whatever one you will install, I think it will work. Are you getting to the cage dipole? Let me let it drop. Six says the cage dipole, it's a bit of a contraption to put together. It's doable and practical, maybe like the 40 maybe even it gets a little ungainly to the assemble the thing, because the disc require quite a bit of size. I've seen them made of aluminum type of bent aluminum type of I don't know what that's that wrong wire for like a heavy wire around number 8, and they bend it into a circle and join it together there with a piece of copper tubing and built into the cage dipole. But I guess it's a bit of a project that we start with. The only advantage really of it is that it will give you a little bit more bandwidth, but other than that, it's a real project to put together. But people first starting out, as Vic said, simple, straightforward dipole works quite well. I think that's about the best way to put it. Over.
Without a doubt. To really get substantial improvement at 80 meters on a dipole, where you can start measuring it because you've gone to the cage dipole approach. You'd like the cages to give you a diameter of something like 10 feet. In my mind, that's impractical. To make discs 10 feet in diameter, to suspend all the wires to make a cage on 80 meters, it's going to give you some improvement in bandwidth, but it ain't worth all that effort. However, you go to the radio amateur's antenna manual under the subject of dipole broadbanding techniques. There are doodads you can connect to the feed point of a dipole. That'll give you a hell of a lot more bandwidth expansion than you can with that heroic effort of a cage dipole. When it comes to VHF, UHF frequencies, where the dipole is only some small number of inches long, and to make it large enough in diameter that it acts like a fat dipole or a cage dipole, electronically they're the same. There it's so easy to do, go ahead and do it. On 80 meters, I recommend you do not do it. Use one of the other techniques of fancy ways of combining pieces of coax cable as stubs along the dipole itself as a broadbanding technique. Also, put in the back of your mind that as beautiful as all those broadbanding techniques are in the antenna handbook of ARRL, when it comes to dipole broadbanding techniques, I'm going to make a rough guess. Only 1/3 of the known techniques are in that manual. I didn't say the others are easy to find. They're scattered all over the universe. With the right kind of a web search, you'll find some of them. And two of the patents that I am filing right now, as we speak, are broadbanding techniques, where I'm looking for something that's way out of sight from what the normal amateur is looking for. A normal amateur will say, the antenna is pretty good. If I can measure, if I can use the antenna, let me drop. At the CW portion of the band, at 3.55 megs, and I go up to the beginning of the sideband portion of the band, 3.75 megs, and if I can span those two frequencies and not exceed 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, the average ham is pretty happy with that. 2-to-1 standing wave ratio is something like 9.5 dB of reflection coefficient. In other words, on your bird watt meter, the forward power and the reverse power will be close to 10-to-1 different.
100 watts out, 10 watts back. That's close to a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. The average amateur is pretty happy with that, and some rigs will tolerate that. In the particular service that I am fulfilling, we're looking for the reflection coefficient to be not minus 10 dB, minus 30 dB. We're looking for a standing wave ratio of not 2-to-1, 1.06 maximum. As an antenna designer for antennas where you care about the efficiency and bandwidth, that requirement is crazy, way beyond the law of diminishing return. But for the particular service I am addressing, that is a definite requirement. So there's a whole class of antennas that I'm in the process of filing patents on, which gives you extremely small standing wave ratios across rather wide bandwidth. I didn't say it's easy, but if the need is great enough, there is a way of getting there. Finding the solution is difficult. Once you've got the solution, implementing it is not so bad. Like many things in life, it's easy when you know how. And we think we're deriving brand new systems to get there. So, when it comes to impedance matching and broadbanding of a simple dipole antenna, you'd like to believe there's only a couple of quick facts and you got it all. A lot more to that than VCI, and the best manuals you can get a hold of are only going to give you half of the available information. Know that ahead of time, and know to go ahead and keep searching. There's better solutions if you need it bad enough. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. All right, let me see if we can answer one more here. These are all from New Ham, Young Ham, mostly, and here's a very good one. I only have 40 feet available for my 40-meter dipole. How do I go about making coils? I understand I can make up floating coils and make up the difference in what is necessary for 40-meter requirements of length. How do I go about figuring this out, Floyd? I can go about it, but I don't think I can give a quick answer on this, Nick. Over.
Yeah, I think I can. First of all, 40 feet of property, and you want to put up a 67-foot antenna. Electronically, 67 feet, I think that's the right number. You've already got... What was that again?
65 feet.
Say it again.
65 feet, 40 meters.
Roger. So the antenna wants to be 65 feet, and he's got 40 feet of property. He's 25 feet shy. There's various ways you can zigzag the antenna, put top hat loading capacitors on it, and loading coils in together. And how do you determine what size of loading coil? Since you know that your dipole is physically 40 feet long, and you can figure out what fraction of a wavelength that is, maybe it's 80% of the proper length for a half-wave dipole. You go to that Chapter 4 of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, and if you haven't got that book, you can get it from the library. If you can't get it from the library, you can get it from a website. You go to WhiskeyAlpha1MikeBravoAlpha.net, WNBA.net. At the bottom of the first page, you'll see Yagi impedance matching information by K2LIW. And there are the two curves I'm talking about from Chapter 4 of the Antenna Engineering Handbook are there. So therefore, you look at the two curves. One curve is the resistance. One curve is the reactance of every possible dipole length you can envision. So once you know the length of your dipole, those curves will tell you exactly what resistance component you've got and how much reactance there is. Once you know how much reactance there is, because the dipole is small or short, it will be a capacitor. And you know exactly how much capacitance it is. And you can figure out how much capacitive reactance it is. Let me pick a number. Let's assume that your dipole is going to have 600 ohms of capacitive reactance because it's too short. If you now wind a coil that's got 600 ohms of inductive reactance and you put it at the base of that dipole, they cancel. It's going to get you down close to the center of the ballpark. You won't be exactly at home plate, but you'll be so darn close that minor tuning beyond that point is going to get you there. That's the theoretical approach. If you use a pure empirical approach, you'll also get there. It'll just take you a couple of hours longer. You wind a coil and try it. And your impedance measuring machine, if you've got one, hopefully can give you, let me drop, the resistance and the reactance component. But even if it doesn't, if it only plots VISWA for you, you've got nothing but a bird wattmeter, and you plot it at 3.5, 3.6, 3.7, 3.8, 3.9, and 4.0 megacycles, and you make a plot, it's a bathtub-shaped curve. And the bottom of the curve is where resonance was. And if the resonance was high or low of the center where you want to be, it tells you whether the antenna is too short or too long. So you will eventually get there by cut and try. But the sophisticated approach is to use the curve. The curve is available to you on a website free of charge. So this is all predictable. Again, it's not rocket science. Now, what I'm telling you is for a dipole in free space. Your 40-meter dipole is going to be some small number of feet off the ground. You're going to get some ground reflection. It's going to disturb those numbers by a few percent. That's not a showstopper. It's just a minor annoyance. You're going to have to readjust things a little bit beyond that. But the dipole doesn't have to be perfectly matched. If you've got an antenna tuner, the antenna tuner will do that for you, as long as it's got enough range in the antenna tuner. And almost every antenna has enough range if you've got the right length of feed line going through it. The antenna tuner doesn't cover the whole clip chart. It covers a fraction of it. Well, your particular antenna can be rotated into the sweet spot on the clip chart for your particular antenna tuner if you add the right length of feed line to your transmission line. Add a little extra cable, rotate it to the right spot, and now you're back in the ballpark. Many solutions to the problem. H-U-K-E-Y, K-Q-R-I-W. How would you have done it, Mel?
Back in the old days, how we did it. Here's a Dick test, a very nice spot. It's available. It's back in the old book. Princess has a chart that it will gave you the copious inductance and reactance as a function of the percentage of the halfway dipole that was represented by your short radiator. So in other words, in this case, you went down to about 40 meters, you went from 5 feet. This was usually the requirement about 40 meters of antenna. And you went down to around 40 feet, basically around 50% of what is necessary for the antenna length that normally you want to put up. So if you look at the chart, they will tell you that the coil at the middle of the radiator, how many ohms reactive they will be. What you will do is simply take that, read that off, and stuff it included in the form of the segment offer. It'll go very quick with the computer because they're part of the ARRL. It has that number of those forms that they have in there, and stuff it included in micro energy. If I remember correctly, exactly, I remember the formula was hexagel times 10 to the 6th power divided by 628 times 3. That was the formula you used. And that will give you in microhenry the requirement of the coil in the space. So you have a way of measuring. Take those coils up and basically install them, and it should be with a little, you know, maybe a little safe, but in your case, you may have to do a little, chopping here and there, or tweaking a little bit, but you'll get it to work, I'm sure, Vic, over.
Yeah, good information, Mel. Mel, because of the machine's grief tonight, you're 50% noise and 50% audio. Therefore, you got to eat the mic. You got to talk loud, so that your voice climbs above that noise, so that people hear all the words. When you play it back from the website, you'll hear some of what I'm talking about. So under tonight's conditions, you got to eat the mic. And so what Mel was saying, I'm going to repeat it with my understanding, and that is when you go to the early chapters, Radio Amateur's Handbook, under the theory section, they got a beautiful formula there saying that if this is the diameter of your coil of wire, and this is the spacing between the turns, and this is the number of turns, You plug in that information to that formula, and it tells you how many microhenries that coil will be. On another page of the theory section, you can look at your favorite frequency, 7.1 megs, megacycles, and X number of microhenries, and that chart will tell you how many ohms of inductive reactance that coil will have. And from those other charts I told you about at WA1MBA, by the shortening of your dipole, you know how many ohms of capacitive reactance your dipole will have. You make that inductive reactance of your coil, because it's got that number of microhenries at that frequency, you make the inductive reactance in ohms equal the capacitive reactance of the antenna. You connect the two together in series. In theory, you've got a perfect match. You're going to have to play with it a little bit. The formula is a very good approximation, 90% accurate. And because your antenna has got a tree nearby and it's 30 feet above the ground, you've got a little bit of ground reflection. You've got some disturbances. But the antenna doesn't have to be a perfect fibula. If the antenna comes out with a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio, and if in your particular Smith chart, you rotate it into the sweet spot for your antenna tuner, and your antenna can take a 3-to-1 VSWR down to 1-to-1, you've got it made. The antenna doesn't have to be impedance matched at the antenna. A hell of a lot of these old flag hams on the 20 meter band will tell you that it's going to catch on fire, it's going to burn down, and pestilence will visit you if you don't do a perfect impedance match at the antenna before you connect the feed line. Pure hogwash. Only 80% of the hams out there will tell you that hogwash. And they keep telling it to each other, and they believe it. It's 95% wrong. I mean that. I believe that. I can give you a hell of a lot of exciting stories of people where did the impedance matching in some other place on the feed line. Back.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
There are a lot of successful stories of where the impedance matching took place back at the transmitter, not at the antenna. You don't have to do the impedance matching at the antenna, even though everybody you happen to run into tell you on 20 meters you had to do that or the world's going to come to an end. That ain't true. I bet you've seen that in real life a few times now. K2KEY is going to eat the mic, K2RIW.
Okay, yeah, this is K2KEY. All right, you're right. Repeater not really working up the par tonight. Dick is 100% right. As we've seen, I guess, a lot of these so-called whitetails get started. I don't know where they start, but boy, they short spread right through the amateur radio community, and a lot of them really, if you sit down and analyze, make absolutely no sense. All right, anyhow, I got a bunch of others. I'll try to answer some of these, but boy, oh boy, I can't, as Dick had said at the beginning, it's a little bit heavy, some of this stuff, to really get into. So if I don't answer you, or we don't bring it up here on a TechNet, it's just not appropriate. Oh, Dick, I wanted to say one thing about, you know, the generators. I have here one in the garage that was built on field day, the Briggs & Stratton. And when I spoke to them about oil, because I had spoken to them about something else other originally than oil, about adjustments, they told me the oil to use in any of these small up to 10 horsepower engines is what you go in and buy, you ask for small engine oil. That's the way it's marked on the container. Small engine oil, they said, is the best fabricated oil for these type of machines. And also, as far as the power situation, when I use it at the field day, the voltage does run a little high. I put variacs. I have each station, each amateur radio station, has its own variac with a meter, an AC meter, so each one just adjusts the appropriate line, appropriate line voltage correctly. That's basically what we do at our club field day thing. But the oil, I could say, is important, and that's what they recommend at Briggs & Stratton. More engine oil. K2RIW, K2KEY.
Oh, nice information. Glad to have that. I'm convinced that multi-grade oil in a lot of applications should be used. Machine's going to close down in approximately 60 seconds, 30 seconds, something like that. 73, you all. This was SIGNET number 1205. 1205. Hopefully we'll all be back next week. And this is primarily a live show. That's where the answers are coming from. Live interface. Don't depend on writing. You write answers, questions to us. There's a medium chance you will not get an answer. We did not promise that free consulting service. 73, you all. Be kind to each other. Back to you, Mel, for the bourbon. KQLAW, bye-bye now.
Dick, Roger, you said it all. By the way, give my regards to Kent, spoke to him, of course, last week, and tell him I say hi to him. 73, everybody, and again, as Dick said, we'll try to do our best. Take care, and have a great week. This is KQKEY.